it's a fun speaker to listen to.
It is. It has no pretensions of being a near-field studio monitor, nor the most accurate line array in the world or anything like that. It's just like, please sit down, put on your smoking jacket and grab your glass of whiskey.
Hello, welcome to Not an Audiophile, the podcast. This is episode 12. I'm Andrew Hutchison, and today I'm speaking with David Carrazza. David currently assists in many ways at the Audio Tailor, which is a near neighbour of Not an Audiophile studio, so handy. But that's really not the reason we've got him in. It's due to his incredible background and wide-ranging knowledge of all things music and hi-fi. So today we're discussing new products, new releases, the industry, opinion, what have you, and we're going to cover it all. Turns out that Tears for Fears released a new album the other day. And it's a live album, largely, four new studio tracks and a bunch of live tracks, which I didn't take too much notice of, except it's from, was shot in Tennessee in this quarry, which is actually not a quarry anymore, it's a proper venue. But and then I'm reading and it's like, oh, it's a film. And the film's called, well, the name of the new studio album, which is about, it's not new, it's 2 years old or something. Long story short, it says so-and-so film. I'm like, oh, a film. And then I just sort of pressed a button and it was like, and then the next minute it says tickets or something. And I'm like, my God, they're showing this film, in air quotes, concert video, if you want, twice only ever, in cinemas around the world, all at the same time.
Okay.
And one of them, we missed one, which was either Thursday or Friday night, and the other one was Saturday afternoon. And it was Saturday morning. So I went, oh, okay, where? Surely not in Brisbane, right? Because nothing happens in Brisbane. Holy shit, there's like eight cinemas. One was at Coorparoo.
How very odd.
Yes. So I don't really know what this is. I mean, and you will explain because you know about these things. But this is they've made a film of the concert. It's not really a film. It's not a feature. Well, it's a feature film. It goes for, you know, two and something hours. But yeah, it was on in a few hours' time, which is why I left early last week, because I went to a Tears for Fears live cinema experience, or whatever you call it.
And was it worth it?
Well, it was interesting, because I thought it would be interesting from the point of view, who's going to go? How has this been publicised? Will anyone be there other than me? Because really, if it wasn't for Sharon playing the new live album and me actually going, that actually sounds pretty good. Yeah, nice interpretations, not studio replicas, but at the same time sounding good and you know, a good, I mean, they're fairly talented musicians, as is the band that they had collected. And long story short, it was interesting. So the people that were there are all of a particular age. Surprise, surprise. The kiddies aren't much into Tears for Fears. And they were all fans. Yeah, I guess that's the people that know, the super fans. Yeah, and so I'm not a super fan, but, you know, I have a respect for them. And it was actually pretty good. But here's the reason why I bring it up. I mean, it was a live concert, you know, in a theatre, you know, in a cinema, in one of those tiny cinemas with, oh, I guess, 30 seats, you know, sort of wider than they are deep, and this is how cinemas are built now, I guess, you know, lots of little cinemas for, you know, for, I guess, a broad range of audiences, and the reality is that I guess 500 people don't come at a time anymore unless it's for a Marvel comic thing or something. So
not anymore, but anyway, that's another story.
Oh, you, well, is that done, is it?
No, the MCU is over.
It's over?
Pretty much.
Oh dear.
I could rant on for hours about the
well, I'll finish this boring story because this,
go ahead.
This comes back to something to do with audio other than the music. beautifully made film, beautifully shot, great performance, sound was good. But I'm sitting there and it starts, and I'd been at a live concert a few days before, and I guess I still had that in my head. And of course, it's very flat, two-dimensional, kind of sizzly and a bit brash sounding, as a cinema system can be, I guess. And a bit light on in the bass. But I'm enjoying it, you know, and I'm thinking, oh, Sharon, who came with me, may or may not be impressed by this. She's not as big a fan of the band, etc. But she seemed happy enough. But I caught myself some time later. So I wasn't impressed with the sound initially, but it wasn't hurting my ears, so to speak. But an hour later, I'm like, this sounds great. This is really good. Bass was suddenly more, I noticed it was suddenly more extended. It was full, it was rich, it was fast. The top end had sweetened right up. It was beautifully balanced. So what the hell happened? There's no way. Two things happened that the mix changed dramatically. Why would it? It's not a live mix, right?
Correct. It was preordained.
That's right. Second thing, the technician wasn't at the cinema re-EQing the system or playing with something or installing new speakers.
Would they even care for a small audience?
No,
like that?
But yeah. Not that it was terrible, but it did sound like an affordable cinema system at the start. So, and then an hour later, it dawned on me. I wasn't thinking about the sound. I was in the concert. It was good enough that I was the same as a film. You'd be drawn into the film. And then I noticed the sound was really good and much to my taste. So I'll just leave that there because I don't have an explanation. Although a previous guest, David Spargo, has strong opinions on this sort of, well, he has it's perceptual this and perceptual that, but in this case it feels like the ear-brain interface, I like to call it, which is perhaps a terrible term, had adjusted itself to what I would like to hear. And of course that's quite scary from the point of view of all of us walking around going, you know, have you ever heard so-and-so's, they're amazing, you know. So anyhow, so David is here, David Carrazza. Is that a good pronunciation or
absolutely brilliant? Thank you.
Cool. David is listening to me prattle on, but he's about to prattle on, so David has a long history in audio of all kinds, which we may or may not cover at some point. But you've had a fair bit to do with music production.
Correct.
Mainly of the electronic kind.
Correct. Yes. Tool of the devil, Satan.
And so you're aware of, and of course you've had an involvement with the hi-fi industry as well, most recently with some very high-quality products. That probably had a little bit of a connection to the pro industry in a way, I guess. We can say what that was. There's no reason not to, I don't think, is there?
No, not at all.
Dutch loudspeakers.
Yeah, Dutch and Dutch. And there's a whole handful of companies now that have got crossover products that go from, you know, kind of multi-track creation monitoring to mastering into the domestic sphere. So you know, it used to be the case where years ago you could count them on one hand and now you can count them on four or five hands. So It's quite amazing how it's diversified.
Yes, absolutely. The world has changed.
It has, thank God.
Well, that's right. So this episode is primarily, other than apparently my observation about the sound changing in a cinema, and I mean it, that was profound, by the way. I caught myself out going, oh no, what's going on here? Because I observed it was not that good initially, and now I'm observing that I'm really enjoying it. It troubles me that. But anyhow, you know, after a lifetime in audio, and you got to get to nearly 60 before you realise you're fallible.
Well, if it can't be measured, it can't be real, right? I say that in profound jest.
Well, I've been reading recently, I don't know if you're aware of this thing called the internet, but there's like stuff on it you could read, and there's
too much
comments stuff to read. From people oh, about dear, things, here we go. And it is at times it is both impressive from the wise comments from someone who clearly really does know what they're talking about, and then there's the other stuff. So to get to the news, though, because this is meant to be about the news, did you bring any news articles with you today, David?
Not as such, but I see you have some that you've previously prepared before you.
Yeah, actually, I have. And to prompt you, one that, excuse me, one that that continues to raise its head continually, as a lot of things that continually raise their head do, is the return to the 70s or even the 60s or the 80s in some cases.
We're talking about retro hi-fi.
Talking about well, what is the correct term? Is it retro or is it renewed vintage or is it re-engineered or is it, what is it? I don't know. I mean,
it's possibly all of the above and none of the above. I think it's an interesting thing to follow because a lot of this stuff is primarily aesthetic, and following from the aesthetic, there is this perceptual assumption that it's going to sound like X.
Yeah, I think, talking once again about perception, which we don't want to harp on about too much and ruin the hi-fi industry, but there is a bit of that, isn't there? So if it looks like something from the 70s, and you were around in the 70s, or at least maybe you've heard vintage equipment from the 70s, do you then, similar to my cinema experience, do you hear a little bit of the 70s?
Oh, well, without question, I've lost count of the amount of times I've been in hi-fi stores, so-called, with vintage gear and people of varying ages. I'm not just talking middle-aged folk who are pining for their youth. Talking about people in their 20s and perhaps their 30s. Who are sitting in front of various gear that is either from the 70s or attempts to have a wink and a nod to the 70s and listening to recordings, more importantly, from the 70s. And you can just see the nostalgia aura emanating from them.
Yes. Which is no bad thing, though.
It's
not
a bad thing. I'm not judging. I'm saying that that's the thing.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I kind of like it, but it's almost on a per sample basis. There are revisions of the past that are really lovely, not just homages to the past, but are really pitch perfect as far as the look. If anything, they're probably better made in some ways. Certainly the standards of fit and finish are probably going to be higher just because of the tooling and tools we have available now. But, I remember, when was it? Was it earlier this year or earlier last year? I've forgotten. But whenever the new A1 Musical Fidelity came out, it was released at Munich. Oh, it'd be the one before. I was genuinely excited because it just looked... And you've got one.
Yeah,
I should mention David does work nearby at a retail store that may run an ad sometime through this broadcast. But I believe you have one over there.
Correct.
What do you think? I think it looks magical.
It looks beautiful. It's wildly understated aesthetically, and it does not draw visual attention to itself, unlike some American testicular power amps that I will not mention.
Which don't even release retro versions. Well, they just have always looked the same, you mean?
Well, I don't know. If you're opening a Jules Verne novel and you're needing an illustration, perhaps they'd be suitable. I will not mention names, far be it from me.
You mean the slightly steampunky-looking ones?
I'm not going to say a word. Mm-hmm. However, the A1 looks gorgeous because it's extraordinarily pared down and minimal. But more importantly, it's one of those so-called retro devices that actually sounds, to my ears, extremely good.
Mm. I've not heard it yet. I mean, I've heard the original ones on a regular basis because I have to repair them. But and I like the sound of the original A1. It's just got that natural sort of cleanness and warmth to it, and it makes music.
Absolutely.
And
sure does.
But the elegance of the design has always appealed as well. And to see one, because I'm not sure I ever saw one absolutely brand new. So to see one brand new now is like, wow, it's like when you occasionally see an original of anything, an old car drives down the road, and rather than being tarted up or hot rodded up, it's just as it was in 1977 or something as it rolled off the showroom floor. It's quite striking, and that's the way the A1 appeals to me. There are other kinds of retro products that are not exact replicas, of course, but are still really great products. And I feel the Wharfdale Linton is a lovely example of that.
You read my mind, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I mean, because it's a fun speaker to listen to.
It is. It has no pretensions of being an Earfield studio monitor, nor the most accurate line array in the world or anything like that. It's just like, please sit down, put on your smoking jacket and grab your glass of whiskey.
Mm. Yeah. I was selling a similar kind of loudspeaker that about three times the price when I needed a more affordable loudspeaker in the stores. This is some years ago, actually about the time that, well, it was when the Linton came out, because A, that was about when I was getting out of retail, but it came out in 2019, I think. And I'm like, I just need something a bit similar to what I'm selling, the UK-built speaker that I was importing and sometime retailing and distributing, what have you, at the time. And I just need something at a lower price point for those that don't want to spend $7,000, right, on this kind of speaker. And so I thought, I'll get a pair in and try it. And it was bloody embarrassing because it was so, well, frankly, almost more fun to listen to. And that's the thing. Like you said, not as accurate perhaps and not as correct in some ways, but fun in the way a lot of speakers in the 70s and the 80s were. They made music.
Absolutely.
And I like it for that. There's other things about it I probably don't like, but they are, those aspects might be the way it's made, it's almost a proper replica in a way, because it's probably made it to about the same standard as the ones from the 70s. Adequate, you know, in the sense that it's a simple box, simple components, probably got a slightly better bass unit in it maybe than the originals might have had, because, you know, well, maybe not in the case of Wharfdale, but a lot of companies were using pressed steel frames back then, and this I'm pretty sure has an aluminium cast frame. But and I see there's a new version of it.
The super version.
Yes.
Above and beyond.
Which then raises the thought, or, you know, okay, so the Linton as it was kind of perfect, I thought, really. Pitch perfect, well priced, included the stands, you could put records in it, it was correct. Fun to listen to. That's why millions have been sold, maybe not millions, but clearly tens of thousands of pairs. And then you have a super version.
Correct.
Will you be getting the super version into your store?
Gentle listener, we have them in our store now.
Oh, do you really?
Yeah, indeed. We unboxed them yesterday. There was a global embargo until, I don't know, a few hours ago. And we unboxed them and we've just started playing it. So it's just burning in. But
what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, kind of cut from the same cloth, although a couple of new drivers.
Yeah.
Sonically, it's somewhat similar. It's a bit more refined, but I hasten to say anything because I haven't really burnt them in and haven't really sat down and had a long listen to them. But, you know, they will appeal to the same customer. But it's an interesting thing corporately what they've done. They've gone up a couple of grand in the price.
Oh, has it gone up that much?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's a little over 5K, I
believe. Oh, is it really? Yeah, okay, yeah, that's interesting. Okay.
So the original Linton, I believe, is still in existence. But the Super Linton is kind of like taking the mantle of the top dog, so to speak.
Okay. I wasn't aware that it was jump. I mean, I must admit, the article I saw where it was mentioned probably only had a US price or something, and I didn't really do the mental arithmetic on the exchange rate, etc. So, okay. Interesting. And And quite coincidental that, I guess you've had them ordered for a while or something. I mean, you can only talk about it
that's
today.
Right. Yeah. There's all that, you know, the politics in the industry about disclosure at certain times, et cetera. But that's in the automotive industry, in the camera industry. It virtually every, you know, consumer object that purports to be desirable and acquirable.
It's already been around
for a while. We always have this, you know, kind of like an index finger up to our lips going, shush, shush, you know, you're not allowed to talk about this secret squirrel business. It's a beautifully constructed ethos.
Well, you guys have done a reasonable job of it because I didn't know it existed until yesterday, and that was just perusing the internet. So the other one that's perhaps less secret squirrel is the Quad 303-33 combo, which I do remember where I saw it, and that was Munich this year.
What were your thoughts?
I thought it looked like a piece of shit, and
what matter of shit would you be talking about, and why?
I have a suspicion, having said that, that the reason why it's been not spoken about since Munich much until I think it was released this week as well, and bizarrely, of course, by the same company, so we should talk about some other company.
We should. Yeah.
But it looked really crappy, fit and finish-wise. I don't think it was plugged in, so maybe they hadn't, you know, got it the way they wanted, electronically speaking, but fit and finish, it looked kind of scrappy compared with the original, which, of course, I've never seen one in absolutely immaculate condition, but I have had the pleasure of working on them on and off for many years, and they are... I mean, Peter Walker was a genius as far as designing a chassis and the way all the bits fitted together so elegantly inside, and this is not to be appreciated, unfortunately, by 99% of the people who listen to these amplifiers because they probably don't care about what's inside, which is, you know, kind of understandable. They care how it sounds, and that's I guess what matters. But as a technical person, when you pull these things apart, and you compared with so much equipment, is just kind of thrown together thoughtlessly inside. All of his products were beautifully thought through, particularly in that era. So. I suspect, well, from the outside, I could see straight away this thing was, it kind of had a few exposed screws, the gaps were not right, and then, of course, it had this ridiculous display for the tone control.
Yes, I've seen images of it, and it just looks a little interestingly
I'm pretty sure those displays did not exist in 1970-whatever when that amplifier was originally conjured up, and so that enters a different realm of this retro era of, you know, reinvention of earlier products, which I don't like. Because there's no way, because that amplifier sounded a particular way because of the way it was designed and the topology internally, and I'm pretty sure the new one, as much as it purports to be similar, is not in a couple of fundamental ways.
Mm.
And one way is that it obviously has a microprocessor in it, in the preamp. There definitely were none in the original, and it has the display, and it has all of, I don't know, it has stuff on it. It even has XLR connectors, sure. I notice.
But it begs a question of, A, why they re-released it as a homage to the original, and B, there are certain marketing assumptions about who will buy this. And my question is, who will buy this and why?
I don't think anyone's going to buy it. Because the people who had the Quad originally are probably almost, well, they're certain, I was going to say something kind of rude.
Expired.
They're either underground or moving off to a nursing home.
Yeah, yeah.
Not probably quite that old in all cases. Certainly some people are fitter than others. But what they are almost certainly in a process of doing is downsizing, although it's not a large product, so maybe it fits a downsizing scenario. Maybe you've got some kind of giant pair of Sonos Fabers with a stack of Macintosh, which apparently they have to go together these days, those two brands. And you're in the process of selling that, and you're going to buy a 33-303 combo to put on your bedside table at the nursing home. But that sounds kind of nasty, doesn't it? I might backpedal from that slightly, or not. I'll edit it out later, as I like to say. So but why it doesn't do all of the things you really want a kind of small system to do. It won't do streaming, I presume, right? So you're going to plug what into it? It's got nothing. There's no sources built in, right? So you're going to plug a turntable or a tuner or obviously some kind of transport or a streaming box of tricks into it. So I just, yeah. So what do you think? And what's the matching component?
It
was oddball in the first place. The preamp and the power amp are two completely different looking products.
God knows we all miss the tilt function of the tone controls. I think we're overthinking this, Andrew. I think, and no disrespect to Quad or their current owners or whoever's pulling the financial and marketing strings, but it's purely an aesthetic, and it's purely a nod and a wink to more than half a century ago.
Mm.
So there is one thing I've really noticed is that there is a strong market for the retro look. Now, I say look quite distinctly from sound.
Yeah.
Because I recall years ago when I was living in Sydney, I was walking down, Sydney people will kill me now, the main street in Newtown, King Street. Thank you, David.
Yes, King Street. Yes.
There was a retro shop at the end of King Street. And at the time, this is the 2000s.
Classic Hi-Fi.
Classic Hi-Fi, thank you.
Free plug for Classic Hi-Fi.
Indeed.
I'll be
indeed.
In touch with them.
No doubt.
They're still there.
Doing
well.
It was remarkable because I walked in and I saw all these boxes of my youth, like early Luxmans and the odd Acufes and certainly Pioneer receivers, which have you seen how much they command on eBay these days?
Yes, I have.
Holy shit. Are you serious?
Now, that's another conversation, yeah.
So, like real vintage. These guys had a really interesting business model where a lot of the stuff that they sourced was taken from Asia, specifically Japan. They changed from 110 or 100 volts, depending on what prefecture you are in Japan, to 240. And, they bit of spit and polish and, you know, it looked like new and, it sounded rather good. But there was the whole, Macquarie banker crowd who'd walk in.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
With lots of spending cash and I'm not disparaging bankers, cough, cough. They walked in and pulled out their folding cash and said, I want one of these because I've seen an ad for these in an old magazine and they look really sexy.
Yeah.
And I think the whole retro thing, and it's still going and I don't think it'll go away. A lot of it's psychological. Some of it's real. Gear from the 70s does have a specific sound, whether you like it or not. It certainly has a very distinct aesthetic. A lot of it's, in my estimation, also pining for days gone by. It's not necessarily about the gear. It's what the gear represents sociologically and psychologically.
Oh, yeah. I get. And like we kind of said earlier, fine.
I'm not judging. I'm just saying that that's why people buy this stuff.
The people talk a lot about, the sound. But, I wonder sometimes whether the sound of the 70s was the sound of the 70s gear now that it's 50 years old. Because it's kind of worn out.
You don't say.
Certainly in the case of loudspeakers, my God, you don't want an old 80s, 70s or 80s pair of speakers. They're shagged. They just are. I'm sorry, but the materials have lost
people, from first-hand experience will know how components age and how they change chemically.
Mm.
And therefore they impart a certain sound, be it good, be it bad.
It's certainly well run in at this point, aren't they?
That's being very kind.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's I don't have an opinion either way. I mean, we're really just observing. I mean, you clearly don't have a problem with it. I mean, you like the Lintons.
I don't. It's interesting you ask that question. Why would I have a problem? I'm not being defensive, but I'm curious as to why you would couch that question.
There's no reason to have a problem with them, except that it's. Is it a waste of energy that we are re-engineering past products rather than moving forward and trying to do something like, say, Dutch and Dutch did, where they had a clean sheet of paper, from what I understand, and just sort of let's build the best possible loudspeaker based on all of the R&D that everyone has done before. So we're going to take everyone's ideas, we're going to have a good look at it, and we're going to sort of have a focused idea of what we want to achieve based on all of this R&D, do our own on top of that and create a thoroughly modern loudspeaker.
Well, look, I understand, and I think there's, the market, the buyers, whatever you want to call the pool of people who buy hi-fi, they're very divergent. there's not a single hi-fi buyer. There's not a type. You could probably subcategorize them, you know, in a very generalized sense. But there are some people who really don't care about what we would objectively and empirically call the best, in inverted commas.
Mm.
There are people, and this cuts across with other hobbyists, shall we say, like people who are into watches or photography, camera people are another mob. There are people who will only touch old film likers and things like that. And not be, and you know, and no disrespect to any particular brand there, but do they buy old film likers because it's the latest technology? Evidently not. It's because it's an old film camera. It has a story, a history.
Yes.
A beautiful history. And it's got the lovely red badge on it. So, you know.
Yeah, I used to believe that motorcyclists were somewhat different because people who like bikes, there are people who we of course know ride Harleys and there are people who ride motorbikes.
Correct.
But then you can, and that sounds being slightly facetious there, but you know, there's an inkling of...
Well, you know, I mean, let's face it.
But let's break that down.
Well, a Harley buyer will buy a Harley because it's a Harley, not because it's a goddamn motorbike.
No, no, no.
It happens to be a motorbike by extension.
Yes.
They're buying the brand. They're buying the so-called lifestyle and experience.
Mm, absolutely.
And this is certainly manifesting.
Well, they are buying that, but then the interesting thing, so you've got in bikes, you've got people who would ride like a large trailer, like a BMW GS. You've got people who would never ride that, but they would ride a KTM 950. Or they might be a naked bike rider, a sports bike rider, super duper proper dirt bike rider on the road just because they can and pull wheelies everywhere.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
And then, but then coming back to the Harley rider, then you've got people who ride Harleys, but then there's other brands of American cruiser style motorcycles, and those paths will not cross largely. I would never have an Indian because that's probably a new rejuvenated version. But also then there's people who ride metric Harleys, as they're called, as in your Suzuki and Kawasaki kind of, and Honda for that matter, sort of interpretations of what a Harley might be. None of these people's paths will cross. But, of course, it applies even more so, I think, in hi-fi.
I couldn't agree more.
You know, with people who love horns, panels, closed box speakers, open baffles, blah, blah, blah. And that's just speakers. And then, of course, you've got your tubes, transistors, Class A, Class AB, Class D now. And then
class
the other
G,
classes.
Class H, Class ADH. Yeah,
that's right.
Class ADHD.
Class ADHD, which actually is quite a popular...
Yeah, yeah.
And then we divide that up now to people who will or will not buy homage to another time products. Mm-hmm. And then you could split that further, as we've just kind of done, into ones that are legitimate revisions and improvements of an old design, which maybe the Musical Fidelity A1 is. I think it probably is. And then in the case of the Quad, I don't think it is. I think it's, like you say, it's window dressing for nostalgic purposes only, which is kind of fine as well. Mm. But slightly, what's the word? Wow, we'll leave it at that. A bit like, no, we'll leave it all at that. But actually, IAG as a group are a bit stuck on vintage stuff at the moment, aren't they? I mean, between the Missions,
yes,
the Dovedales,
indeed.
The revision of the other Wharfdale, you know, the Linton and the Denton, then now we've got the Quad. They kind of had already done it with new Quad valve amps, which were actually quite good, but interestingly done 20 years ago and not popular. Not really. Maybe they were too damned expensive. It was also just prior to maybe tubes becoming popular again. But anyhow, so anything else to say on the vintage retro front? I think we've worn that out. I mean, we're really just venting about it to some ways.
Well, I don't know about venting. Look, it's going to stay here. It's going to be manifest for years. I don't think it's ever going to go away. There's a certain subset of hi-fi buyers, consumers, listeners, whatever you want to call them, who will pine for the fjords.
Mm.
They'll want the old stuff, whether it's the original old stuff or new iterations and interpretations of the old stuff. So, and that's fine. It's the great thing about our industry is it's so wildly diverse. We're a very broad church.
Yeah, yeah. And just as a finishing touch on that, someone told me this week, and it was either you or any number of other people, sorry, that I who I may have spoken to this week, said Pioneer was maybe breaking away on its own from its current owners or whatever. Does that mean we can look forward to, you mentioned Pioneer receivers of the 70s? I mean, that's what you'd do, wouldn't you? Well, if you were Pioneer?
Possibly. Pioneer, poor things, have gone through a bit of a rough trot
kind
the last few years.
Identity but, a bit. So, I mean, how do you get it back? Maybe just rejuvenate the 70s, which wouldn't be all bad.
I could think of worse strategies, Andrew.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. But the problem is the way they were made, they'd be so expensive to recreate.
They'd be poisonously expensive
to make them. $20,000.
Yeah, absolutely.
So as much as you're right, the value of secondhand Marantz and Pioneer receivers is very high, at an all-time high. If you tried to recreate one to the same standard, oh my God, they would be $20,000. You know,
well,
one of the big
people and the market by extension has been spoiled the last decade or so, because we've got a lot of, well, you know, even more than a decade ago, a lot of manufacturers went to southern China and other parts of Asia for their fabrication. I remember when the Levinson Group under Harman started building in China, and I thought, wow, this is interesting. This will set a precedent, and it did. And, you know, we've got stuff now that's historically quite inexpensive when you, you know, adjust it for inflation and everything else.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You're bang on the money. If we were to go back and manufacture, say, amplification with, you know, your big toroidals, your proper caps, your, you know, your XYZ components in a chassis that's extruded from a solid hewn block of granite, and all the other good things, in inverted commas, that we used to do, the price would be out of the reach of most people.
It would be. Because hi-fi, unlike homes, has actually hardly been affected by inflation. Even though Peter Comos want to say that the reason why the Dovedales cost as much as they do now is because of inflation, but nothing else has actually gone up. I mean, if you forget the retro reinventions, you can buy a pretty damn fine loudspeaker new for $3,000 to $5,000 to $6,000. But the, you know, they are a big box. They're hard to ship around and what have you. But I mean he makes an argument for that's why the huge difference in price. But I guess I'm losing my own argument here, because you can't make an argument. There are examples, thanks to China and high volume manufacturing, where the value for money equation is so high today on consumer goods of all kinds. Your phone being an example, probably the best example. The technology in that is astounding, and yet they're $1,000 or $2,000. But yeah, other stuff, of course, is, you know, high end American and European brands are kind of outrageous amounts of money. But that comes back to they're made in very small volumes. I don't know what I'm trying to say, except those Japanese receivers of the 70s, as complicated as they were to make, they had a focused workforce who could do good quality work, and they were made in enormous volumes. You know, they were made in, I would say, oh, I don't know. They would have done a batch of 5,000. I would have thought.
Easily. But you've got to. You know, we tend to forget this. That structurally, our society has changed enormously in 50 years.
Tell me how.
Well, what we considered seriously, there's a manner of ways I'd be here for hours. But the stuff that impacts our industry and most of consumer electronics is this: 40, 50 years ago, there was no internet. And there were no computers, at least consumer-based, of any functionality anyway, really. I mean, you know, we can always talk about whimsically about the Apple II and the Tandy TRS-80, but they weren't real computers by our standards at the moment.
Not really.
Well, not really, but we forget.
No graphical user. Well, Apple II had...
Yeah, but let me finish my story. Yeah, okay. I mean, we forget that comparatively... with a phone, Android or iOS, whatever it is, it's got more computing power than a Cray XMP, for God's sake. And that I find absolutely astonishing. I really find that astonishing. There's no technical arena that I can think of that has this totally exponential increase in power. There's simply nothing. Getting back to my thesis about how we've changed is that back in the 70s and 80s, well, music was really a binding force for a lot of people, not just young people, but certainly young people. One of the rites of passage of a lot of young people was, you know, oh, I've got this artist or I love this band and, oh, do you love that band too? We're part of this secret club and we love band X and we don't love band Y.
And we're not telling anyone about
it. All that jazz. So it was as much of as an identity branding as anything else. And because there wasn't, you know, people playing Minecraft for 20 hours a time on your Steam account globally with 300 other friends trying to kill you, you know, that stuff, music was far more centric. It was far more...
Oh, yeah. Well, simpler times.
Simpler times, but, there was far less distraction, but music actually... this is my position, and I could be... persuaded to be wrong, but I think music had far more relevance to people's lives, certainly 30, 40 years ago, than it does now.
Yes, absolutely. And does the retro thing, to go full circle, as much about, for those more mature customers who are interested in a look back at the past, whether by buying genuine vintage or the retro revisionist brigade of products, is just about just wanting to in some small way relive a time when things were simpler, were more about, well, music.
Yeah.
And just less distraction, I guess. And, I mean, you know, there was really, and I've said to people forever, you know, oh, why is hi-fi not as big a deal as it was? And, of course, hi-fi is a bigger deal than it was in the preceding 20-odd years. But in the preceding 20-odd years, I would say, well, internet, really. I mean, basically, and all of that ability to communicate, it just means that there is, I guess you've just got, because you've got toys, there's less time. I remember when the internet became a thing. I spent the first 7 years on the internet just doing the internet, learning stuff. And I do, it does strike me that the current crop of smarty pant 20-somethings, they really are so much smarter than I was in my 20s. Because I had to go and buy a textbook and trawl through it for the facts that I needed. It could have taken a couple of weeks to read it. Well, you just go tap, 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 tap. And assuming you can choose a reliable source for your information, you've got it immediately and it goes on. And you, I mean, it's a great time to be alive in a way.
Well, it's opportunity cost. I mean, this may surprise you, but we're all going to die one day and we have a limited amount of time on this spinning rock, apparently. So what I'm trying to say is with opportunity cost, one can spend one's time in front of a screen on on certain sections of the web, whether it be 4chan or whether it be Reddit or whether it be the more murkier aspects of the interwebs, or we can kind of like have our brain numbed by certain other websites and indeed social media portals, but that's irrelevant. The point is you are choosing to spend your time there rather than sitting down in front of a stereo and actively listening to music. Yes. Now, neither is good nor bad. All I'm saying is there's a resource called time and you determine where it goes.
It is finite, indeed. Yes, as to where you might end up.
Yeah.
I think we're getting away from hi-fi. And on that note, we will have a short break.
Good.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for listening. Hey, if you could rate, review, or follow, or even subscribe if you're on YouTube, the show, that would be fantastic. On Apple Podcasts and Spotify, I'm pretty sure it's follow. If you could follow, that would be great. If you want to, you know, you don't have to, but it would be very much appreciated. And without any further ado, back to the show. So we're back. We're back with a new exciting line of discussion. And one that it just occurred to me yesterday, and I thought you're the ideal person to ask David about this. So, what specifications do you take any notice of on a hi-fi product? Because it occurred to me, and I'll preface this question with my own thoughts, so you don't feel uncomfortable answering it.
Go on.
I take notice of almost none.
I take
more notice of how deep it is and whether it'll fit beside a cabinet.
Well, that's probably a more real-world metric. Specifications, oh, God, what a hoary chestnut we're going to open up now.
Let's keep it simple because okay. I reckon I then thought further over lunch yesterday that there is a couple that I care about.
Sure.
But then I thought they're less specification than more, you know, is it, okay, loudspeakers, is it a panel, is it a closed box, mm-hmm. reflex mm-hmm. box, is it horn loaded or something, is probably going to tell me more about whether I'm going to like it or not.
Yeah.
But then I realise, aha, that's, because if we're kind of directing this conversation more towards a beginner audio equipment enthusiast, or at least someone who's, you know, just as much into music as equipment and is kind of interested in, you know, it's hard. You don't have that experience to know how those different products sound. So really it's not a useful specification. Oh, a horn loader speaker is probably going to sound a particular way because it's more sensitive and maybe it'll sound maybe a little horn loaded, but most don't these days, thanks to computer modeling, etc. So they're the things is it an active speaker or a passive speaker? And it's the case if it's an amp, if it's tubes, transistors, whatever. But then if you're not such an experienced listener or experienced with the equipment, you don't really know maybe how a tube amp sounds. And of course they all sound different anyhow, but it's going to sound a little bit like a tube amp. And then if it's single-ended, you go, well, it's going to be not particularly powerful, and if it's a push-pull, it'll have enough power to drive a normal speaker. That's as much as I realise I investigate the specifications.
Is that the question?
Well, the question is, do you find yourself taking any notice of specifications? And I think my point is that I don't.
Yeah.
I certainly don't care about distortion figures.
Well, personally, very little. It depends. A lot of it depends from which manufacturer it comes from and how it's predicated as well. A lot of manufacturers just, you know, roll out specs saying blah, blah, blah. Like, for instance, frequency response between X and Y with a, you know, +3 dB envelope. Here are the turning points at, you know, kind of we dive precipitously at 50 cycles and there's nothing above 18, or we're DC to light and flat or whatever.
DC to light. I'm not
come on, you must have heard that. But, you know, it's all very interesting, and a lot of it's, you know,
DC kind of, to light plus or minus 0.1 of a dB.
Correct. A lot of it's to assuage people's fear about, well, this is, you know, it predicates what it's going to sound like. Oh, you know, it's going to sound like this. And you haven't even unpacked the speaker or the goddamn amp, and already you're presupposing what it's going to sound like. So that's an interesting thing. I think that is always in play with a lot of people. But you make a really good point. People like us and some of our colleagues that will be listening have been in the industry for years, and we've heard hundreds, if not thousands, of pieces of gear. And we've built up a mental map and an audio map of what things generally sound like.
Yeah.
Now, the novice who walks into a store or walks into a mate's place listening to a system, if they've not had a lot of exposure about anything, they'll probably be blown over by most things. I mean, just a very quick example of this.
Yeah.
When I was lecturing in engineering production and critical listening at the Conservatorium of Music in Brisbane here years ago, I remember some of my students, a lot of my students were just young, between, I guess, 17 and 20 thereabouts.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, they would congregate in the hallway with their Macs or their PC laptops open, and they'd be watching YouTube, and, you know, this god-awful, heinous sound would be coming from their laptops. And I'd be like Gollum going, "Hey, it burns. And I'd just kind of roll my eyes, and we'd all walk in and I'd deliver the lecture. And I noticed this after about five or six times. I'm thinking, I've never seen these people actually listen to, obviously, because they're not dragging speakers around, but even talk about good two-channel audio.
Yeah.
And I asked them, during one lecture, I said, you know, how many people have a stereo system at home? And I think about three hands went up in the entire hall. And most of them had things like UE booms or, you know, JBL Bluetooths, you know, not disparaging the brands or the people. And I said, right, okay, here's what I'll do. Because I was living at Sunnybank at the time. Mm-hmm. I said, look, I tell you what, if five or six of you want to come over for dinner one night, I'll cook you a slap-up deal, a meal, and I'll show you. I'll sit you down and listen, and, you know, you can have a listen to a two-channel system. And at the time, I won't mention brands, but I had some really excellent tower speakers, really excellent amp, and a bloody excellent turntable.
Yep.
So I thought,
okay. Wow, so you were going to play him a record.
Yeah, I thought.
And this is a few years ago, right?
The kids are into this. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so anyway.
Was that pre-album, pre-vinyl boom?
No, this is only about 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So they knew what a record was.
Yeah, yeah.
They certainly hadn't heard one played properly.
They'd never seen one as skeletal, the turntable as skeletal as this, and that's as far as I'll go. Okay. And anyway... The stylus went into the groove and this hologram manifested itself in the room. And it's cliche to say it, but the jaws actually slackened and dropped and they just looked at one another like with it. It was a huge Road to Damascus WTF moment.
Yeah.
And then after a couple of tracks, I couldn't shut them up and they said, play more, play. I had to kick them out at around 11 o'clock saying, listen, I've got to work tomorrow.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Wow. I guess we all kind of had that moment. And that's how we ended up where we are now.
Indeed.
A lifetime later, but, half a lifetime or, two-thirds, whatever it is. Yeah, that's great. So you've ruined their life now.
Well, they can't unhear what they heard. No. That's the problem.
Yes, yeah.
But that's also a good thing because once you have a strong, or at least start to have a strong frame of reference with anything, whether it's cars, wine, sex, clothes, music, whatever – there's no going back. It's very hard to go
back. Apparently the first time is the best time as well. So, I mean, it's
the first time is always the best
time. So really they're just...
Or the most terrifying, perhaps.
Chasing the dragon. I mean, that's almost why people keep coming back into hi-fi shops, isn't it, and changing equipment there.
Well, you understand what I mean. I mean, it's I often joke with colleagues and friends saying, hi-fi's... like heroin, it's just as expensive but more benign.
Yes.
And it is for a lot of people, it's a drug, but a benign
probably equally
one.
As damaging to some people's mental health. Certainly. I mean, it's...
I'm not going to argue with that.
That's great. So they, I mean, what were the? They loved it. They wanted to keep hearing, I guess, music that they knew or, because we all do that. I guess we get a new piece of equipment at home and we're like, oh, how's it going to sound? I'm like, that's amazing. I'm going to play something else. I wonder what it's going to do, so there was a bit of that. But were they saying things like, we never knew this could exist or this
Correct.
Did exist?
Correct. You know? They were utterly gobsmacked by me because experientially, two things had happened. Number one, I think that the most salient thing that they perceived was holography, like three-dimensional placement of items in a space.
Yes.
And this went across the board, whether it was an acoustic recording or whether it was totally synthetic production in the studio. Kraftwerk's a great example of this, Daft Punk, et cetera, et cetera. And I was playing orchestral stuff. I was playing some Prokofiev and what else was I doing? Shostakovich's Fifths. And they were just gobsmacked because they'd never heard true dynamic range, true image placement, and extension and that metaphilious notion
full
of
range
detail.
Sound.
So,
I was going to check what this light's saying on this machine. Oh, that's all right. That's fine. To come full circle to what we kicked off about, so they weren't asking about any specifications. What is the specification?
They didn't give a shit about the specifications. No. They were just admiring the magic that was taking place in front of them and between their ears.
Yeah, and so that's kind of. I don't even need to read my comments because I can remember what I wrote, which is that I basically wrote that I don't. Maybe I should read it. I don't take any notice of specifications when it comes to listening to equipment. So don't take any notice of specs prior to listening to a piece of gear. I couldn't really care less. I mean, we know it's going to be properly manufactured. It's going to produce enough volume. It's going to sound basically correct, undistorted, and of a certain level of quality. We can't draw any real conclusions from the specification.
You've got to listen.
It's a 500-watt amp or it's a 12-watt amp. There's 12-watt amps that sound pretty grippy in the bass. We know the 500-watt one will, but that would depend entirely what speakers and all sorts of other things. So, but I then make the comment, I take an enormous amount of notice of specifications slash measurements when I'm either repairing or designing a product. Less so repairing, because we're really just trying to put back what the original designer had already created, and we're not really redeveloping it. But in the case of developing a loudspeaker, the measurements are without, well, you can't progress without measurements. You know, you can, I mean, ultimately it's the decisions are made based on how enjoyable it is to listen to, but to get there, you need measurement. But when it comes to choosing hi-fi, and I will assume a scenario where you can listen to it, not make decisions over the internet, which is, of course, fine for those who wish to do things that way, but is ultimately coloured by more of a desire to save a small amount of money, or perhaps because you live somewhere not handy to a hi-fi store. So those are not reasons. They are. Well, let's not go down that path. The point is, you go into a shop. Hi-fi is about listening, right? You should really be either at a mate's house who's got a system and listening to that, if you can't get to a hi-fi shop, and make assumptions about it. But the point is, you want to listen. You listen and you either enjoy it or you don't. I don't think there's any, I mean, you don't, if you're a beginner, you don't know what camp you fall into yet. You don't know whether you're a Harley rider or a BMW rider. So start somewhere.
Can I make listening. A point there?
Yeah.
This is crucial, and it's something that a lot of people don't, well, they misunderstand, or they don't understand this correctly. There's this bullshit narrative that says you are either objective or you're subjective, and the answer's somewhat in between. And you bang on the money about when you're designing or repairing something, you need those metrics in order to get the product right.
Yes.
However, it's like wine tasting. I mean, seriously, does any sommelier pop in a pH meter into a glass of Beaujolais and go, well, it's pH 7.2, I can't possibly drink it.
No, that's right. That's unacceptable.
Well, you know, and gentle listener, I would argue strongly that this happens at all stages of our hobby, whether we're a novice or whether we're 20 years under our belt, 50 years under our belt, whatever. There are times I can count on one or two hands where at various points in my life, you know, and I'm not talking when I was young either, where I've popped in a piece of gear in my system and I've listened to it and I've literally recoiled and gone, holy shit, what is this?
Yes.
And
yes.
It's happened to me once or twice at hi-fi shows where I've walked into a room, there's this unassuming thing, and someone has devilishly played, say, Toccata in Fugue, and yeah, okay.
Which version?
Well, the one with a lot of bass, you know. They all have a lot of bass. And these goddamn speakers were making this noise. And it was just like, this is not possible. And it just rearranged the mental furniture for me.
Yeah. Well, that brings me to one of my pet subjects, which is all about listening as well, is, for crying out loud, anyone who's listening to this and is an enthusiast and thinks that they know how things sound, or they're interested in knowing how things sound, for crying out loud, go to a major hi-fi show. I mean, everyone says, and when I say everyone, every YouTube hi-fi expert says you can't judge sound at a hi-fi show. Well, that's utter horseshit. Of course you can. The systems are playing and turned on. Yes, it's not an ideal environment.
That's what they're saying. It's not an ideal environment.
Yeah, they're also saying that there are certain ones that say you cannot expect to get good sound at a hi-fi show. I've heard amazing sound at hi-fi shows. So it's about having a room fortuitously that perhaps has a lower level of ambient noise and less, you know, leakage from other rooms. Also about having polite people in the room who aren't yabbering too much, and that is a problem at shows because lots of people are excited and want to talk, and you need to forgive a certain amount of chatter, I think, but because there is business that needs to be done, and so we won't go on about that too much either, because, you know, I've strong opinions about that. The business does have to be done. It's an expensive exercise, very expensive. No one really realizes how expensive. It's horrifically expensive to get there. So you do need some kind of return. Maybe something needs to be said at that moment. Be patient, wait for the room to get quieter, da-da-da-da-da. Some systems are more sensitive of room acoustic quality. Some speakers live better in a tougher space, etc. But I've heard amazing sound at shows consistently, and I've heard what I think is the character of some brands at shows, and it's not to my taste, which is probably how I end up being a lover of certain kinds of gear, but like you, I'm quite often amazed. The most amazing thing I heard at Munich this year was a horn speaker. I'm not a horn speaker fan at all, but these didn't sound like horns.
Mm.
These sounded like music. They were amazing. And yeah, I didn't expect anything, and I was literally, well, my jaw was slack. Like, genuinely, this is so close to having a small, you know, a four-piece in the room, you know, a four-piece string ensemble type. Not ensemble. Well, I don't know what the definition of ensemble is. How many people make up an ensemble? Could it be a quartet? I don't know.
It could be.
It could be. Anyhow, there were people playing stringed instruments, and they sounded pretty bloody good to me.
Good.
That's I don't know music, but I know what I like.
Yeah, well I know that, and that's an old joke in the art world. I may not know art, but I know what I like. And then
there's a picture of dogs playing pool on the
wall. Well, you know, it's really funny. I don't want to waffle on about my past, but I used to be an art dealer and I had a gallery for a while. And the amount of asinine comments I received from people walking up to paintings they couldn't have possibly conceived of, let alone executed.
Yes.
And, you know, and they come out with this horseshit about, like, oh, my kid could do this. Or the best one was, I had this Central Desert piece from a sadly now deceased Aboriginal painter of some renown. And he looked at it and he goes, mate, is it finished yet?
Bastard.
I just thought that was funny. But, you know, I mean, I remember going to the what was it, Mona in Manhattan years ago, and I was in front of a Mondrian, and I just thought, gosh, this is the first time I've seen a Mondrian, and gosh, it's really beautiful.
Yeah.
Because, you know, photographic reproductions on the web or in print can't really reproduce the glory of art up front. There was this guy from Nebraska, God knows where he was from, and he was there with his wife and his kids, and I swear to God, I'm not making this up, it was oblivious to the fact that I was by the side there, and he goes, oh my God, you could do that, Timmy. You know, and he said it, and I just rolled my eyes and walked off. I'm thinking, what the fuck? You know?
Probably the only bit of fancy art that I've seen that I'm pretty sure I can do is some of the stuff in Tate Modern in London.
Okay, here we go.
You know the ones I'm referring to.
Oh, I know. You mean you could arrange a bunch of bricks on the floor?
No. I could paint. I can roll out a canvas in white. Yeah. I can roll that out. I can even hang it on the wall. Yeah. I could definitely do that.
Yeah, we're going down a very slippery path about what conceptual art is since the 1950s, but we could spend five podcasts on that, but our listeners will go to sleep.
Yeah. Yes, because I think there's supposed to be some mention of music or hi-fi equipment.
Indeed.
I'm with you on the where you insert a piece of equipment in your system and you go, wow, and you re-listen to your whole music collection, which if you've got Tidal, could take a while. But we'll get to that in a sec. So specifications, not part of the equation though.
Mm.
So to answer the question and actually offer some advice perhaps to the listener, I'm not sure I have any, but I mean, if we're not really looking at any specifications, I mean, so what are we looking at? So in the case of, say, a turntable, we're going, well, if it's a Lin, it's going to sound a certain way, I guess, and we know it's a quality product. Mm-hmm. And we're telling the listener a Lin turntable probably won't sound bad. It may not be the best turntable in the world either. If it's a Riga, it will be of a certain quality, even a P1. If it's a Project, it will probably make a decent sound. If it is a Marley from JB Hi-Fi, it will not...
God help you.
It will not be very nice for a variety of reasons.
Well, can I just...
So we don't need to read the specifications because the turntable's been made for different... The Riga, the Project, the Lin are all about trying to get the best out of the record.
Yeah, maximum out of the record.
The Marley is something else.
Let me give you a direct real-world example that staggered me. And I'm saying this not to boast. But
and what I meant by that, and I didn't mean to be nasty about Marley or the product, whatever. But the point is, specifications don't need to be read. But people I know don't realise. People ring me up and go, oh, I've got this Marley turntable, I want to fix it. And I'm like, why? Oh, it's broken, it's a year old. Yeah, well, get a proper turntable. And they don't know. So I guess, and it's slightly, it sounds slightly nasty to say they're no good, but it's a piece of information. We all know it in the hi-fi industry. Like a, what's that other, Crosley. I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
Worse again, right? Yeah. So you don't need the spec. Get back to what you're saying, though.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, I just hasten to add, I'll be very quick.
To avoid
just
want to a legal case.
Yeah, possibly. Where's my Casey? Basically, with that stuff, a lot of the neophytes, they don't know, if you'll pardon the phrase, shit from Shinola about stuff. And so they, in great innocence and great naivete, walk into a store and some person who is equally ignorant is going to sell them something that they don't need.
Yeah.
So that happens. But this is why reputable hi-fi stores, please God, exist. I was about to say with specifications, another thing too is from personal experience, I found astonishing things. Like, again, I want to preface this by saying I don't want to brag. It's not about, you know, pissing rights or anything like that. But I had the two best turntables I ever had in my system were so diametrically opposed in terms of design philosophy, it wasn't funny. The first one that totally changed what I thought a piece of source gear could do was a Goldman Reference.
Mm-hmm.
I was lucky. I think about there was maybe three in the country that were ever imported.
Yep.
100 kilograms of just over-engineered Swiss nonsense.
Yep.
And as soon as the stylus hit the groove, it was just like, it was only your auditory senses that worked. Everything else just went away.
Okay.
And that's the only way I can put it.
You went sort of limp, is that what you're saying?
Well, I was living in Sydney at the time. I had some friends who worked at Sony 301 Studios. I invited them around conspiratoriously, said, come around, we kind of listen to some vinyl. And we did. And they were just agog because they were firmly ensconced in the digital is better camp and rah,
okay.
rah, rah.
Yeah, right, yeah.
That's fine.
So this was at a particular time when records were done at this
stage. Well, yeah, it was done. This is very early 2000s.
The 1990s
even when people were throwing out vinyl weep.
Yeah.
And you know, I had some.
Well, they were
throwing out vinyl. Literally, by the
people
truckload,
would they would just put it in the bin
because
it wasn't worth anything.
No, it wasn't. But you know, what really changed my perception of how good vinyl could sound was this goddamn 100 kilogram piece of Swiss engineering.
Yep.
Fast forward. A few years back, I sadly and stupidly sold a Goldman, but you know, you can't move around Australia lugging around 100 kilogram turntable.
Yep, yeah,
all that jazz. So I bought a Riga P10 with their factory fitted moving coil.
Mm-hmm.
And it too was stupendously, stupendously good, way beyond that its price tag would seem to suggest.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And here we have two tremendously different turntables, one more than 10 times the cost of the other, and one more than 10 times the weight. Well, let's say 100 times the weight.
I would say the P10 weighs, well, if you took the platter off, you
bugger
could,
all,
you
yeah.
know, weighs nothing.
A kilogram
yeah.
or whatever yes. it was, seriously. So, you know, and this, from a purely empirical point of view, does your head in because you think, hang on, you're thinking, this manufacturer X has employed this design philosophy to achieve outcome Y.
Mm.
And this manufacturer has used a totally, completely different
in every way.
Ethos to design. Yep. But the outcome Y was equally delicious and lovely.
Yes, but different, I guess, in presentation.
But different, yeah.
But
equally,
probably not that much different.
No, this is my point. The point is that both were extraordinarily musically valid, but they came from totally diametrically opposed design philosophies.
Yep. And, for what it's worth, I do like the way Riga does things. I mean, that light, stiff, it's practically, as you found out,
correct.
So much easier to move from home to home. And so much more easy to buy as far as the amount of shekels that need to be sort of poured in a funnel into the hi-fi dealer's bank account.
So I know it's a circuitous route for an answer.
Back
but again,
to specs.
If you were to judge turntables by mere specifications, i.e. weight, mass, and dimensions, all that jazz, forget it.
That's right. So one thing we could say is you can't judge a turntable by specs at all. What do you do? I would say under $10,000, it's basically indexed to cost, isn't it? Performance is largely accurately indexed to cost.
Correct.
And obviously you don't skimp on how you mount the turntable. It needs to be, you know, mounted in a way that obviously it's not affected by vibration or air currents in the room or what have you, of the structural vibration. And then also obviously spend an amount of money on a cartridge that's, you know, in proportion, assuming it comes with a tone arm, in proportion. Get a decent phono stage, in proportion.
Correct.
So amplifiers, yeah, it gets a bit more complicated. But, I mean, you got to buy one that's got the features you want, right? That you need to get right. If you need digital in and you need a certain complexity, it probably limits the kind of amplifier you can buy, but you could have an external DAC. But you can't get bogged down with the specs of a DAC. You have to listen to the DAC. And then there's the camp that's all DACs sound the same, which I wish that was the case.
Life would be a lot less expensive if that was true.
It's just, I got four DACs in a room and I spent about 4 hours. And I did do blind testing. I had a mate with me and he played different things. I'm sorry that the name DAC, which was 10 times the price of the least expensive DAC, was consistently easy to tell that it was playing and it was more enjoyable, and that's the end of that. And then, it's probably changed now to some degree, maybe or maybe not. I mean, I'm not even convinced that DAC chips sound better than they used to 10 or 20 years ago.
No, I think...
not just the chip, the
well, it goes with the implementation. Yeah, I mean, equally, if not more important, is the current to voltage.
There's people laughing right now going, this guy's a fool and an idiot. Because about R2R and...
Well, it's, again, as I was attempting to say, you know, it's all about how they implement the filters. I mean, a lot of manufacturers, and I'm not accusing them of being lazy, but it's convenient and cost-effective. Like ESS are a perfect example. They provide the manufacturer with a bunch of onboard filters.
Mm.
And so virtually all manufacturers say, yeah, we'll use the ESS filters. There are a couple of maverick designers who go, you know what, we can do better. And they've done better. And I've heard these DACs. And I'm just like, ah, okay, wow, this sounds really good. But again, you've got to have a great power supply, good analog stage. It's everything.
Yeah. That's right. So DACs sound different. You're going to have to listen to them, sorry. And that will be... potentially a black hole you may travel down. Get back to amplifiers. Amplifier power, distortion, noise floor, etc. I'm sorry, it's highly unlikely that you're going to hear any real difference in signal to noise ratio in an amplifier. They're all pretty quiet. If you really want to play it loud, yeah, you're going to need some power. You're going to need preferably sensitive speakers. If you're a teenager, as we all were once, I had large speakers and a powerful amplifier that I built myself. It was loud. It was great. It's what I needed at the time. It was still only 50 watts. But in a room this size, that's the size of a large bedroom, basically, it was tons with a big pair of KEFs. So power is just not that big a deal. Distortion, I think, yeah, it's probably an important thing, but I think it's something you're going to hear in the resultant sound and you're going to need to listen to it. So, I don't know. All amps sound different. I know there are pools of people on the internet who say that all amps sound the same. These people need to get off their keyboards and start buying audio equipment and listening to it.
Either that
or get their ears cleaned out.
They patently don't, if I can just give a bit of personal experience too. And again, I probably, at least intellectually, was in that camp many years ago. I'm thinking, you know, if they measure the same, they've got to sound the same. What could possibly go wrong?
Mm.
And again, in that system that I had in the 90s when I was in Sydney with the Goldman as a front end, am I allowed to say, I've already said brands, so I can say brands, can't I? No one's going to come out with a scimitar and lop my head off.
I think it is a waste of our and our listeners' time to not either up the good stuff and shit on the crap.
Okay, can I blaspheme and talk about the Krill integrated amp? I think it was KSA 300 or whatever the wretched thing was. Well, this is when Dan was still designing for Krill back in the 90s. And it came up secondhand in Sydney somewhere and I hopped in the car and went out and bought it and brought it back. And I'm like, wow, I've got a Krill integrated. I popped it on my electrostats with my Goldman feeding it. I just thought... like the imaging, like it just collapsed. It was like a hard sheet of pressed metal in front of me.
Yeah.
It was the worst goddamn thing I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah.
2 weeks later, I went to a certain place on Parramatta Road.
Yes. And you bought the Krell.
No. I got rid of the Krell quick smart and some poor devil purchased it. You know, may I rot in hell. I bought a Gryphon DM100, which is a Gryphon entry level 100 watt per channel power amp, and had a Class A pre at the time. And I popped the Gryphon into the same system, and it was just, it was revelatory. It was like, how can these things sound so utterly, utterly different?
Yes.
And they're solid state.
Yes.
And they're designed by reputable designers from reputable companies, and yet they couldn't be more different.
No, absolutely.
One made music, the other made me run out of the room.
Yeah. And even though we started this episode today with me alluding to concerns about whether we really could judge sound quality, ultimately, I sat there for an hour or so and noticed that it sounded better, and we could explore how that happened, and maybe someone will not get a DVD, but I mean, I guess you download, it's going to be on Netflix, whatever. Someone's going to hear that concert at some point and go, it does sound better in the second half. Yeah. And that will be the answer, but I don't believe that's the case. But we all know though, I mean, look, bottom line is, you either like it or you don't.
Absolutely.
No doubt you didn't sell the Krell after an hour, you know, but it didn't come good after an hour either.
No, it didn't. That's the whole point. I look, psychologically, I was invested in it wanting to be good because I paid good money for it.
Yes,
I'd taken time out of my life to acquire it.
Yep.
I plugged it in, and of course, I'd read all the glowing reviews. This is before the internet. This is when we had flat dead trees with ink on it.
Mm.
And, you know, reading all the mags. And there it was, and it was just like, wah, wah.
Oh, yeah. We've all been there.
Yeah.
This brings on, I was almost going to bring the subject to reviews up today, but, you know, maybe we won't.
No,
but,
that's another.
No, that could go for hours. But and then you could say, well, is it system synergy or is it just that amp sounds awful? And, I think there is a system synergy thing there. It's a big deal. I mean, certainly when you develop your system at home, you are searching and you're tweaking around the edges to maximize the synergy between components and the acoustics of the room, and for your own and balancing that against your own tastes. But in this case, one could say it's probably not a case of taste or synergy. It just was not a great sounding amp. And I say that because no doubt you tried different things.
Indeed.
To get before you made the decision, I've got to get rid of this thing. Mm. And then bizarrely, like you say, you put another amp in and magic happened immediately.
Correct.
Yeah. So So get back to the spec thing. Once again, this is why, folks, we're not looking at specs. And then the reason why I bring this up is because I was listening to someone else's podcast the other day and they were crapping on about, there's a particular guy, I can't think of who it is, and probably best that I don't even say who it is, but he knows who he is and he won't be listening to this. So 0.0000001% THD versus 0.00001% THD on another component. And he's going on and on about it. I'm like, you got to be joking, right? Like, that's a mental illness at that point, isn't it? I mean, that's seriously, like, you are so, you are not any kind of authority on audio gear if you are even mentioning these numbers. These are so far below audibility as to be ridiculous.
Yeah, well, look,
that doesn't mean the two products don't sound different, but this is not the reason.
There's an analogy, if I may make it, in the world of photography. And it's interesting how a lot of people who are into hi-fi are strangely into photography as well. And this is all about...
And own motorbikes.
I'm sorry?
And own motorbikes. Possibly.
Yes, possibly.
In many cases.
And a number of other divergent pursuits.
All fast cars.
However, isn't the end outcome or the end purpose of a stereo system to listen to music and enjoy the music? Is it not? Is it not a vehicle for the music? Okay. Similarly, in the photography realm...
But then it has to tick some other boxes. The gear has to look...
Yeah,
has to appeal to the eye.
Let me finish the analogy first.
It has to fit into the room.
Let me finish the analogy.
Yeah, and it has to fit the wallet.
True. There are people in the photography world who will, and for those of you out there listening who are into photography, you'll know the YouTubers, you'll know the bloggers, you'll know who the hell I'm talking about, will invariably do what's known as pixel peeping. They'll look at a camera sensor and go, oh, it's only 16 megabytes, or this one's, you'll need 100, or you'll need, you know, 16 bits of depth on your TIFF file and all this jazz. And all this is hubris. All this is a total intellectual distraction from the actual purpose of photography. That is to create an image that is compelling.
Yes.
Now, I've seen photographs that were done, I swear to God, on point-and-shoot shitty cameras with 6-megapixel sensor that I adore. I've seen stuff done it depends what aesthetic you're after. I mean, you know, if you're doing archival stuff for museums and art galleries, yeah, you'll probably need a Phase One or a Fuji GFX or something with sufficient resolution for archival work. But the purpose of photography is to entice you with an image. The purpose of hi-fi is to entice you with a sound.
Yes, yes.
And how you get there, cannot be mapped out with specifications. Bitter history has taught me that. There are some things that measure really badly yet sound strangely good, and vice versa.
Yeah. I agree with one, or with a slight twist or caveat, which is I think things that that measure completely wrong, that are really bad, but fluke occasionally the right, I mean, I'm thinking mainly loudspeakers, because they're the things that tend to be really, really wrong, but you can occasionally get them in the right place at the right time. Absolutely. On the right amp, and then they kind of work. But overall, the measurements and the reputation of a product to be room sensitive tend to coincide, that they measure somewhat poorly. And you know, certain products, you know, you know, like Bose 901s have a reputation for being, some people will be saying right now, shit. No, they're actually a weirdly good speaker in some ways, and they look kind of cool. And, you know, I kind of like them to look at. They measure weird. They're an odd speaker. They need active equalization to even work at all. They have a reputation for being room dependent, like very much if you put them in the right space they work. And maybe I've picked a bad example in form of the 901, but it they can sound amazing in the right place, but yeah, they measure kind of weird, and they're not they got all sorts of weirdness about them because they are weird. And so that's why they're in that category of hard to get along with. And then there are the same could be said of Linus Barracks from years ago or whatever. You know, they were hard to drive. They were relatively insensitive.
Absolutely.
Like a lot of isobaric speakers are, apparently. And but in the right place at the right time on the right amp, wow.
Oh, yeah, they were spectacular.
But
yeah.
So there is a correlation between not measuring particularly linearly or well. And, I mean, let's face it, a sensitivity figure is a number that is probably more important in a loudspeaker than, so like a very low sensitivity figure is going to create a problem. 82 dB or something is definitely a problem.
Indeed.
And they probably weren't specced at that, but they may have been close to that. We might have a break.
Please.
And then we will wrap up. Hello, everybody. Thanks for listening. Hey, if you could rate, review, or follow, or even subscribe if you're on YouTube, the show, that would be fantastic. On Apple Podcasts and Spotify, I'm pretty sure it's follow. If you could follow, that would be great. If you want to, you know, you don't have to, but it would be very much appreciated. And without any further ado, back to the show. And we're back. Back to discuss Tidal. Mm. Not the brand, because apparently there is a brand of electronics or something called Tidal.
There's also a brand of washing powder called Tidal. Or maybe that's Tide.
I think it's just Tide.
Maybe I'm just Tide.
There is, but there is a music streaming business which is called Tidal. Duh. And I don't know. Do you have thoughts? Apparently, they're having trouble working out how to make a profit.
Well, most streaming companies are, except Apple and Google, but they don't need to make a profit.
No.
It's interesting if you track back a decade or two, or maybe a decade, 15 years, and see the ascendancy of streaming services. I mean, Tidal was really interesting because it was the first one that really said, hey, we're going to actually work with a bunch of artists. And, I mean, people like Jay-Z, Madonna, Deadmau5, et cetera, all mm-hmm. on board going, yay, we're going to have, you know, kind of high-resolution streaming over the interwebs and it's going to be great. And the business model seemed to be doable. What they didn't bet on was the elephant in the room. And I'm not talking so much about Google, but I'm talking about Apple.
Yeah.
Because Apple, when Apple had iTunes and it was just like, what was it, 256 kilobit ALAC or something, it was okay. It was better than MP3, but it wasn't anything to write home about.
Yep.
Well, as you know, a few years ago, Apple said, you know, bugger it. Mm. For the same price, we're going to give you full
lossless
44/16-bit over AirPlay, and away we go. Well, that kind of fucked up Tidal's business model to a great degree.
Yep.
Because Apple has a huge ecosystem out there. A lot of fans, and for what is it, $11-$12 a month, Aussie?
Yeah.
You get Apple Music and bloody blah. I mean, I was a Tidal subscriber and I love Tidal, especially under Rune. It worked extraordinarily well.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's dead, but since Jack Dorsey, ex-Twitter, bought it under his, I think his company's called Block, they're like most kind of late-stage capitalists. They're going, you know, we really need to make a lot more money than we're making.
Yeah.
Let's eviscerate 10% of the workforce, which they've just done. Tidal's kind of an answer without a question for a lot of people now. I'm not saying it's done. I don't think it is. I think there's a lot of people who, not using other streaming services, will love Tidal and continue to use it. That's all very well and good. The question remains, can Tidal make a profit up against Apple and Google? And if Spotify go high res, it's probably game over for Tidal. Who knows?
Yeah, I thought Spotify was going to go high res, but they haven't, have they?
They've been threatening that for years.
Yeah. I couldn't give a shit about Spotify. Yeah. I'm an Apple user as far as the phone. I don't believe in it as far as computers, so I'm sort of got a foot in both camps. And I don't get on with iTunes, and yet many people are, you know, obviously I interact with it because this podcast is, you know, at least on 40-something% of occasions is being listened through Apple Podcasts. It's a great system. I like the way it works. I'm a Tidal user and have stuck with it from the start. And I was exposed to it early on because Name, which I was involved with at the time in retail, were an early adopter, if you like, and they gave us an account.
Yeah.
There's two stories with that. One is that I had the account for about a year or so before I even logged in because I had all of my CDs on a hard drive. Yard Records, I guess. We were selling turntables and we were selling CD players and I had boxes of CDs.
Yeah.
So I just didn't feel like I needed it. And then one day someone said, oh, this streaming stuff, you know, what's this? I've heard about Tidal. I goes, oh, actually, I've got it. Why don't I blog in and see what happens?
And what happened?
Well, that was the end of that.
I
put the CDs upstairs on the mezzanine, put the records back in their sleeves, except for the one that I used to use for demo, and I haven't used anything other than Tidal ever since to listen to music, basically, because it's great.
Well,
except one thing.
What's that?
Well, they don't seem to be as bad at it right now, but they albums would disappear.
Mm-hmm.
And so often the album that would disappear is the key album of any particular artist. So in the case of, say, Fleetwood Mac, you know, obviously it was rumours would disappear. But I don't think that ever happened with that particular example. But that's the example I'll use. So if it was some particular, you know, there'd be one album missing and it'd be really annoying.
Yeah.
They seem to have fixed that problem. I don't know what that was about. You may throw some light on that, but yeah, I like it. I like the way it works, but I say that in ignorance of what Apple is like, or the other one,
Google.
Yeah, I don't know anything about that at all.
Well,
how's Google work for music?
Well, badly. Please explain. Badly in my estimation. Look, I'm not a fan of the whole Google ecosystem, but I don't want to go down that political rabbit hole. Let's leave that for another time. But the point is, just from a purely economic point of view, Tidal can't compete with Apple, and probably certainly not Apple, and probably not Spotify. That said, I was a Tidal user for many years, and I love Tidal. I think it's probably the best streaming platform in the sense that the audio is really good. Its algorithms for suggesting new and like-minded stuff is very, very good too. Beautiful interface, probably the best interface out there.
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, I don't know. Because what's the other, not Geezer? Geezer. Yeah,
Cobuzz.
Cobuzz.
Yeah, yeah.
Where did I get Geezer from?
Well, oh, no, they're useful geezers, mate.
No, there used to be one that sounded like Geezer. Deezer.
Yeah, yeah. There's all these aborted
but
platforms.
But Deezer's gone, right?
Yeah, well, most of them have.
So So how? Okay, so what streaming platforms are left? So you've got Spotify, Apple, Tidal, Google, but I don't know what that is.
Yeah, just Google Music.
Google Music, okay. All right.
But I don't think Google, you know, some listeners may waggle their finger at me. I don't think it's serious contender to... In the hi-fi realm, but, you know, again, poor old Tidal, as much as I'm kind of there, you know, standing on the stadium rooting for them, in the American sense of rooting for them, you know, I'm thinking, yay, Tidal, go Tidal. They made some, what's the euphemism, some missteps, shall we say, with the adoption of MQA and then the sudden, like, we don't want MQA anymore.
So that's gone away.
Well, it's kind of gone
tits up. Is it gone away?
Let's see which venture capital mob have bought them this week. I don't know. And quite frankly, I don't care. It was kind of an answer without a question.
Yes. So we're going to lay bets on the future of Tidal. It sounds like you're saying 50-50.
I think it is 50-50. I'm not a gambling person or betting man, whatever you want to say, but... Look, I am a realist, and I think Apple have just got so much momentum with Apple Music. And I know, you know, kind of non-Apple users, like yourself with phones.
Well, half Apple users,
but, you know, people with iPhones and iPads and, you know, I mean, you can play Apple Music on a PC. It's not as if it's, you know, platform dependent. It's platform agnostic, actually. You know, it's just, it works. It works really well. It's typical Apple. It's straightforward. It doesn't cost much. Software. And it just works. And when you've got the capital reserves of Apple, and you look at the capital reserves of Tidal, and, you know, Jack Dorsey's not exactly a fool, and if he's going to hemorrhage money for the next year or two, he'll just pull the plug.
Well, that's a shame, I think. But that's the world, you know. See, things change, and I love the idea that one day Facebook won't exist, but it's, you know... I mean, but it won't. At some point, it will be gone.
Well, I actually got out of Facebook, when was it? Back in 2011 when it was on its ascendancy and people were frothing at the mouth about it. I was one of these, you know, with strange people who actually read end-user licensing agreements. You know,
For
a lot of people, it's like religious. What? Well, you know, a lot of people, end-user license agreement are like religious texts, and I won't mention religious texts, but, you know, they kind of scroll to the end and go, yeah, I accept that. They don't read the fucking thing, for God's sake. They're purporting this worldview or this, you know, kind of mythology of, you know, kind of otherworldliness, and they never even read the original text. Ye gods. Anyway, so I actually spent a good half day reading the end-user licensing agreement. And
all right.
As I got more pallid during the day, I thought, there's no way I'm putting anything up on here because I own total mechanical copyright on everything
there. Those agreements. Do I want to use the product or not? Yes, I do. I will have to.
You have a choice.
I'm pretty sure if you hit no, the installation process fails. You know.
Do I feel a Beretta pressing against my temple?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's. This is just going to prove that I know nothing about technology. But when you install an app on your phone and it says, you know. Allow access to your contacts or any other. I don't like that. I feel like they're immediately uploading the contacts to their giant database. They must be able.
Well, a lot of apps do that. A lot of apps they track you, and the metadata leak out of a lot of phone apps, regardless of whether it's Android or iOS, is if people knew how much data was being harvested on a daily basis, they'd shit in their pants.
It must be a lot because
it's heaps.
I think both in my life, you know, the two of us, we've got both phones, although one of each type, both got phones, one of each type. And we both use a bit of social media for work, not none of it personally, but I tell you what, it's got to the point where the ads that I'm being served, I'm not even sure that I've spoken.
Mm-hmm.
I've just had the thought, oh, I need a new battery drill. And then the next, I'm using the battery drill.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's like, this thing's kind of rooted. I should get another one. And the next minute, well, maybe not the next minute, but within the next 24 hours, I'm being served ads for Makita. What
manner of sorcery is
how?
This?
Has there been an implant or something done? And I'm confused. How? It's like they're reading my mind. But I guess they're collecting so much data.
That's the point.
They're combining. Yeah,
that's exactly.
I mean, I guess, do they know that I've been in a power tool store?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because
they
of
do.
The tracking.
Absolutely,
I guess.
They do. The metadata is so rich. It's not just kind of geolocating. It's how often your phone's on, you know, who you've spoken to, how long you've spoken to them, and whereabouts you are during that. And it's much deeper than that.
So you're having a phone call and they're listening to every word of that.
Well,
when I say listening.
Not so much, but they know certainly the length of the call and the recipient and how many cell towers it went through. So they can triangulate and know exactly where you are. But that's been around for decades, man. It's...
Yeah, but they've refined it, haven't they?
Well, of course they
well,
have.
Well, do you find that?
Every intelligence agency on the planet knows this. It's
well,
old news.
Yeah, I don't know anything. I'm too busy just getting through the day.
Yeah, but it is what it is. It goes back to your metaphor about, you know, kind of like, do you want to use this app? It's like, do you want to use a contemporary phone that has internet access? Well, yeah, I do. Well, honey,
you're
going to pay the price.
That's right.
You know, we're going to harvest your data. That's why things are, you know, I mean, people are really funny because they go, oh, geez, these... bloody TVs at JB, they're really cheap, aren't they? I'm going, shit, there's a reason why they're cheap, because the licensing agreements they have for all the bloatware on their OSs are there. I mean, you know, you can buy a 55-inch, you know, backlit micro LED, mini LED TV for $400. I mean, it costs them more to make it. It's just the licensing that pays for it, man. But when
Yeah,
seriously, just have a look at the license. This is why I use, like, I buy parcel.
So reverse licensing in a sense.
Well,
the manufacturer is getting paid to get more units out there.
The manufacturer is getting paid by the software licenses. Like, for instance, if you have a Google OS or whatever OS, Tenzin and all the others, they have agreements with ad, you know, kind of cyber ad agencies, if you want to call them that. And so... if you want a smart TV in inverted commas, you want to use those smarts that's built into the OS and the TV.
Yeah, yeah.
Part of the user licensing agreement is that, you know, we have the right to track what you watch, when you watch it, what ads we serve you, how long you look at the ads. I mean, yeah, but that's just... I mean, I don't know why you're laughing. I mean, that's perfect commercial sense.
Of course
money.
It does. It makes complete commercial sense. Of course you would. You would do that to... you know, leverage more accurate ad placement.
Correct.
But I just don't think about it very much.
Most people don't. And, you know, they don't have to. But we're crafting a world. There's a great book called Techno-Feudalism. The ex-Greek economic minister, Yanni Vanasakis. I'm sorry, I may have rooted his name. But techno-feudalism...
In which sense? The American sense or the Australian sense?
In
the Australian sense.
I may have mucked his name up, mate. But Yanni Vanasakis, I think it is. Techno-feudalism, look it up. Fantastic. It talks about how contemporary capitalism is going away from production and building of goods. It's all about not even building of services or... software, it's about hosting platforms. And Google, Amazon, etc., Apple Music, anything that's you've got a subscription to, Netflix, etc., it's all about a hosting platform. But read the book.
Got to make the content that goes on
Netflix.
You've
still got to make the content. But do you think that Jeff Bezos buys any of the stuff that Amazon's hosting? The answer is no.
I would,
No, you have to pay for the privilege to be on Amazon.
Amazon
take a cut. Thank you very much.
No, I'm aware of that only from the point of view that, you know, back in the day, if you were producing a TV show or something, that you would pay to have it aired on, on Channel 10.
Well, it's a similar thing.
Maybe you wouldn't pay to have it aired on Channel 10. Maybe 9 or 7.
Anyway, we're getting off topic.
Yes.
But fundamentally, go ahead.
All right. Well, I think we're done. Yeah. But I really appreciate your time, David. That's fine. Very, very interesting stuff. I think the listener would like to have you back on again.
Okay.
I want to say the listener. I think there is only the one, really. Sharon.
Well, whoever you are out there, I'm sorry I've prattled on.
No, good stuff. Very interesting. And I guess next time we have you on, maybe more structured questions. But, you know, it would be always, you know, people can, of course, send an email. The details are on the website. The website is notanaudiophile.com.au. And the, but there's, you go to YouTube and we're there and you can make comments.
Well, I think it would be great if the gentle listeners, plural, I hope, would
there's actually quite a lot of listeners.
Good, that's yes. Great. That's good.
Hundreds. It's
very, very heartening.
Judging by our data mining.
But if there are topics that you'd like us to discuss, we'd welcome that for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. That'd be great. Yeah, because we have no imagination. All right. Thanks again. And thank you, listeners. And we'll be back. We'll be back very soon. Thank you again. Bye.